Greetings and welcome aboard. It's the Wednesday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there, Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host for this almost hour. Almost. Of observation, insight, and absurdity. It's almost daily, too. Because stuff keeps getting interrupted. You know, just life. Anyway. Welcome aboard. Good to have you along for the ride today. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast for a Wednesday. This one being the 15th of July, 2020. I hope you and yours are doing well. In the run-up is the intro music, or the pre-show music was playing. I was scanning through the web looking for things to chat about, and I found an article that I've got to share with you. It's funny, from time to time, I do find things right in the last few minutes, and this is one of those times, and I'm actually finishing copying and pasting into my little list here right now, so I make sure I get everything I need to pass it along. Okay, there, now this, and this. All right, now I'm done with that. So, it is a midweek edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. We are halfway through the week. We've made it this far. Doggone it, we're going to make it to the weekend. We've got to. I mean, we've put this much effort into it. We've made this commitment. Let's stick with it until the weekend, shall we? Okay, let's do that. Let's see. Yesterday was basically a non-eventful day. I got a haircut. I didn't actually do much work on the car because, you know, I was going to have to get out in public, and I didn't want to have to go through this process of scrubbing myself down, because I get, you know, I tend to get pretty nasty when I'm working on the car because I'm crawling around under it and I'm getting greasy and all this stuff. So I did a little bit of cleanup and painting on some parts, and that was about the size of it. But I did spend a pretty good amount of time plotting and planning and coming up with ways to do things. And that's always necessary as part of a project like this. And that's the way it works. I'm hoping I'll see some parts coming today. I need to check my my tracking on some things. But I'm waiting on some stuff to come so I can start working in earnest again and really getting some major things done, and hopefully by this weekend actually be driving the little red car. That would be good. But other than that, it's been kind of uneventful. Nothing major to talk about around here. We've had a runoff election in the Senate race in Alabama, and Jeff Sessions has, it looks like, ended his political career. Maybe he's going to retire now, because former Auburn football coach Tommy Tuberville defeated Jeff Sessions in the runoff election last night, and Sessions did concede last night, and this is a win for Donald Trump. Actually, in this election, he did very well. Trump did, as his endorsements are winning again and again and again. And this time, Tommy Tuberville. Now, it remains to be seen how well Tuberville will do against his Democrat opponent here. And we're all hoping, honestly, speaking as somebody from Alabama, the vast majority of us are hoping that Tuberville can pull this off, that he will win in November, and that we can finally get rid of the Democrat puppet that's currently serving in that position right now. Yeah. We're hoping. I'm not even going to mention his name. I mean, I'm really not, because he's cited, every now and then he sides with the people of Alabama, but most of the time he just does whatever Chuck Schumer wants him to do. And we're just tired of it. Really, really tired of it. But other than that, not much else really to talk about on a personal level. It's just been kind of slow around here. We did get out, my wife and I did get out and vote in the runoff election last night. And we go into these things wondering what possibly we have missed. Because there's always, as I mentioned the other day, there's always something on the ballot that you look at and go, well, where did this come from? An amendment to what? But last night it was, there were two races on the ballot. That was it. Just two. So it was like, okay, check, check. See ya. And we were out. And we went to get tacos. That was pretty much the day yesterday. There you go. It is, hang on here, I'm getting back to where I need to be. It is the middle of the week. It is Wednesday, the 15th of July. And what are you doing? Stop that. The I opened a webpage to look at it, and it started playing a video automatically. I don't like that. Don't do that. Hopefully you are prepared for your weekend. You're ready for your weekend, and you have a good weekend ahead of you. You're looking forward to it. I know I am looking forward to the weekend, because hopefully this weekend I get to drive a little car. That would be fun. But between here and there, there are things to talk about. So let's get started. The Atlanta Wendy's, where Rayshard Brooks was killed by the police last month, has been torn down. Yesterday, multiple reports came in saying that this Wendy's was taken down. Videos showed construction crews there yesterday morning using an excavator to demolish the charred remains of the restaurant that had been set ablaze by protesters on June 13th, the day after Brooks was killed. The site had served as a focal point of demonstrations in the following weeks. A Wendy's official told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, "This is being done in a thoughtful way, with safety as priority and in cooperation with city officials. There are no additional details to share at this time regarding this site." In other words, they're not going to say whether or not they'll rebuild this Wendy's. It'll be interesting. If they rebuilt this Wendy's, do you think it would end up getting torched again? I do. I think that sometime in the middle of the night, some mindless sheep with a Molotov cocktail and a brick would break a window and burn the place down. I really think that would happen. And that's something, of course, they're thinking about. Andy, you, of course, remember why the Wendy's got burned down. It was because Brooks was fatally shot by police as he was running away, pointing a stun gun at them, which he had already discharged, fired at one of them and disabled them, and was firing at another one. He grabbed the stun gun away from one of the officers during a struggle. And those prosecuting the police officers say that Brooks was not a threat. But that goes against the grain of police training. It goes against the grain of policy. He was using what the attorney general for that area had labeled as a deadly weapon against the police. Of course, his death reignited demonstrations in the city following weeks of violent protests across the United States over George Floyd's death in Minneapolis on May 25th. Trust me, this stuff has not been about George Floyd. George Floyd was the catalyst, was the excuse, but this stuff was not about George Floyd. It really wasn't. Protesters had camped out at the torched restaurant for weeks, refusing to leave, unless their demands for police reform and a memorial for Brooks were met. They were forced off the property a bit over a week ago after 8-year-old Sakoria Turner was shot across the street from the restaurant while riding in a car with her mother. Sakoria is set to be buried today, by the way. The suspects have been arrested in Wendy's arson case, including Natalie White, she's 29, who Brooks identified as his girlfriend in body cam footage from the shooting last month. She denies setting the restaurant on fire. Atlanta police officer Garrett Rolf and officer Devin Brosnan both surrendered themselves to law enforcement last month, one day after charges were filed against them by the Fulton County District Attorney over Brooks' death. The district attorney, by the way, is under Georgia Bureau of Investigation for various and sundried fishy things right now. Rolf faces 11 charges, including felony murder, while Brosnan was charged with aggravated assault and violating his oath. Now, you have to remember that felony murder is the murder of an individual during the commission of a felonious crime. A police officer committing a felony and shooting someone, defending himself and the people around him from someone who was pointing a weapon. Atlanta police say they believe Wendy's was responsible for tearing down the restaurant, but not the city. Well, I would think that would be so, that Wendy's would tear it down, because as it was an insurance liability. And of course, they would tear it down. It just makes perfect sense that they would. So they've torn the Wendy's down. There's no smoldering or charred remains for anyone to camp around and use as a memorial. There's nothing there to mark the site as a temple to a slain person who had a record and was known to the police. A guy who was out of prison on parole, basically. He really was supposed to be in prison. He was afraid to go back, but that's why he was fighting so hard when he got caught. He knew that if they cuffed him and they took him in, he'd be back in prison. So he fought. And in fighting, he overpowered, and an officer took his taser, used it against him, and as he fled, he turned and fired the taser at the other police officer, who was also attempting to tase him. And then finally, the police officer pulled his service sidearm and fired at Rayshard Brooks and took him down. It's a sad situation, a tragic situation, but it's the old saying, don't do the crime if you can't do the time. And this is a guy who had done time because he had done crime. And a guy who knew that if he crossed the line again, he would wind up doing time again. And he indeed did cross the line. He was operating a motor vehicle while under the influence of alcohol, so much so that he had fallen asleep in the drive-thru line at Wendy's. And people were having to pull out around him to get past him in the drive-thru line. He was blocking traffic there, which is why they called the police. So a guy is passed out drunk in front of Wendy's in the drive-thru line. The police come, and you've seen the videos. I know you have. They treated him with the utmost respect. Hey, man, I just wanted to make sure you're okay. You know, you were passed out there in the car. And he told them, yeah, I understand. You're just doing your job. They treated him with respect. He treated them with respect until the handcuffs came out. And then he fought like a wild man to keep from going back to jail. And in doing so, he took a weapon off of a police officer and fired it at the police officers. And in doing that, he signed his own death sentence. It's a sad thing. And even more sad than that is the response of the community. A community that for some reason idolizes and defends its criminals, the worst among them. It is a bizarre situation. And it's a sad situation for America. But the good news is, the Wendy's has been torn down. There is no longer a memorial there for a criminal who fought with police, stole a weapon, and fired that weapon at them, endangering not only them, but the people around them. Farewell to the Wendy's. And I would say good riddance to you, because you were being used for a purpose you were not built for. In an exchange with the press, but some are calling controversial, President Trump stated some hard facts about police violence against blacks. He correctly noted that there were quite a few more such cases against white people in a truncated attempt to bust up a narrative that Blue City police are specially targeting black people in systemic racism. In an unfortunate exchange with the CBS News, Catherine Herridge, she was asking, why are African-Americans still dying at the hands of law enforcement in this country? President Trump replied, so are white people. So are white people. What a terrible question to ask. So are white people. More white people, by the way. More white people. Which is perfectly true. But it didn't stop the artists in word salad making over at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the and NBC News, to name a few, from hailing that factual statement as controversial, if not all outright falsehood. We'll take a look at that when we come back after the break on this Wednesday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Don't go anywhere. We're watching you. And we're back. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there. Scanning social media in the break. My buddy Mike posted this one. This is the best quote I've heard from a black pastor. Quote, "We need to tear down the crack houses before we tear down the monuments." Wow. So true. So very, very true. You know, Candace Owens has been talking about this for a while. And not long ago, she boiled it down, talking about how the black community celebrates the worst among them. And they run to their defense. The very people who are destroying their neighborhoods, the very people who are destroying the parts of town that our black communities live in, those people, when they get in trouble with the law, when they break the law, when they participate in criminal activity and they get caught and they're taken down, the black community runs to their defense. Instead of saying, yeah, get them out of here. They're ruining our neighborhoods. They're destroying our children. They're tearing our lives up. They run to their defense. They help them hide. It's just amazing. Absolutely amazing. I agree. Tear down the crack houses before you tear down the monuments. And back to the article I was talking about a little while, the Coming From American Thinker, written by Monica Showalter. Here's some verbal acrobatics from a so-called fact check from the New York Times. This is about Trump's statement that more white Americans are killed by cops. Quote, "This is misleading. Although more white Americans have been killed by police than black Americans, black Americans are killed at a far higher rate than white Americans. Since 2015, the Washington Post has logged 2,499 white Americans killed by police for a rate of 13 per million, compared to 1,301 black Americans for a rate of 31 per million. Let's start with the sentence, although more white Americans have been killed by police than black Americans. Stop right there. Right off the bat, that makes Trump's statement factual. Percentages or rates of killing were not part of Herridge's question, nor were circumstances of killing. According to Statista, 370 whites and 235 blacks were shot to death by police in 2019. In 2020 so far, 204 white people, 105 black people. The white total exceeds the black by a high margin. But wait, the percentages, even if you wanted to go there, which Catherine Herridge did not, no information within the data was about circumstances, such as were these killings justified? Were the police being shot at first? Was there a hostage situation? Were the cops being assaulted or attacked? What color were the police who did the shooting? Which would negate a lot of the claims of racism right there, given that many and often a majority of Blue City cops are black. Or was it really a human rights violation, which is what most people object to in police killings? There's no context at all. And let me just interject here. You're talking about these percentages. The percentages are behavior-based. There's more criminal activity. We've talked about this before. Black men are responsible for a vast majority of violent crime, which is why there are more black young men in prison and why more black young men are killed by police. percentage-wise, a higher percentage. That 13% of the population is responsible for the majority of the violent crime. All you can say from the hard data is that, yes, more whites than blacks are killed by cops. And if you want to criticize all police killings, well, that makes whites the largest group of victims, if victim totals is the game. None of these numbers, or percentages, prove systemic racism, which is what the press was looking for. As NBC hailed the remarks as controversial, the New York Times called falsehoods, and the Washington Post claimed was a Trump bid that, quote, highlights white victimhood, which it was not. It was clearly a truncated effort to break the canard about systemic police racism. He says, that's a terrible question. Remember? What's more, there's evidence that since the Ferguson killings of 2014, white cops are less likely to shoot at minority suspects than whites. That's according to a report from NPR, which further complicates the systemic racism in police forces that the activists claim and the reporters eat up without questions. Catherine Herridge, whose intellectual rigor is well known, likely was asking a question she didn't come up with herself, a broad, open-ended question that invited an anything-goes response. Trump's answer was factual, yet what Herridge's bosses wanted was some kind of confirmation of systemic racism in the country's police forces as the accepted premise. Since Trump didn't bite, responding with actual facts, however you want to read them, the bias in the question was evident. It was simply a bid to whip up more protests and riots and more election fodder for Joe Biden. Had Herridge asked about rates of killings or something more precise, Trump could have asked her what the crimes and incidents leading up to the shootings were, and then asked if the circumstances were the same with white suspects who were killed by cops. It was a gotcha question with an off-the-cuff answer, and the press is looking for something new and racist to pin on President Trump. The falsehoods of the New York Times claim actually belong to the Times. The New York Times and these other sources are looking for anything they can find, to throw at the president, to stick to him, to use as ammunition against him. And Catherine Herridge, who has some serious creds, I believe was stuck in a situation that was a no-win situation. She probably had someone over her head saying, you will ask him this question. And Trump just shook it off. Good for him. Back to the percentages. It's important for us to remember, as I said before about Candace Owens, most of the violent crime in America is being committed by a minority of Americans. And our prisons are populated with people who have been committing those crimes, and their community is running to their defense. And when Candace Owens asked why, it's a good question. Why would you do that? What you should do is point the direction they went when the police come by. What you should do is call the police and tell them, hey, I know where they went. What you should be doing is getting these people off of your streets and out of your neighborhoods. You should be dealing forcefully with these people. The only way you're going to stop the crime and to make your neighborhoods safe for your babies again is to get these criminals out of your neighborhoods. It's the only way it's going to happen. And what's happening now is people on the left are demonizing anyone who will stand against the criminals. and they're using the tag of racism to do it. And people like Al Sharpton are on the warpath again. And according to him, the Trump administration wanting kids to return to school is racist. Racist. Racism. It's all racist, I tell you. Yeah, everything is racist. Have you noticed that? Everything is racist. And it's not. Everything is not racist. Of course, the racist tag is being used because racism is an ugly thing. So to shout racism makes people recoil. Ew, that's nasty. You're a racist. And since our schools are not, our schools and our parents are not teaching children how to really think for themselves, they just accept what they're told. And people like sheep are led around by the nose. Oh, that's racist. It's not racist. Al Sharpton, now he is a racist. And we'll deal with the Reverend Al coming up after the break as the Daily Perspective podcast continues for this Wednesday, the 15th day of July, 2020. This is the Daily Perspective Podcast. Thanks for being there. Glad you're along for the ride today. Is it just me? Or does Chicago's mayor, Lori Lightfoot, look like some character from a bizarre movie? I'm not really trying to be mean here. It's just that I just get this, you know, it's just... There's just something about her. I just don't know what it is. Don't know what it is about her. But, you know, there's just something odd about her. Anyway, I just keep... And the reason I say that is she's popping up in the news cycle. And so I'm seeing her picture popping up, being interviewed by different people. And there's just... She's just got this look about her that's making me... It's kind of wigging me out, baby. That's all I can say about it. It's just kind of wigging me out. I just don't know. Anyway, maybe she... I think she looks like Gollum. Anyway, back to another character, and that's Al Sharpton. According to the Reverend Al... Gosh. The Reverend Al. Hold on a second. Oh, this is better. Yes, here we go. Oh, yeah. Yes, that's right. The Reverend Al. Liar. Al Sharpton. Liar. Yep, he's the guy. Every time you see him, you know he's lying. Mm-hmm. On Saturday evening's Politics Nation, Al Sharpton railed against President Trump's plea to reopen schools this fall. He then urged viewers to vote the Republican president out of office. Sharpton claimed that President Trump's only pushing to reopen schools this fall to make the country feel more normal. Quote, you want to send them back to school at any cost on a misguided attempt to restore some sense of normalcy in this country. You want to shift the focus from your mishandling of the pandemic that has cost so far the United States over 100,000 lives by sacrificing the health and safety of school children, faculty, staff, and their families. Trump and members of his administration, like Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, have consistently stated that the safety of students and faculty members is their number one priority. Yet, the Reverend Al continued to make baseless claims about the president's agenda. In his normal race-baiting fashion, he ranted, "Your insistence that public schools be forced to reopen isn't just self-serving and dangerous, it's racist." It's racist! Oh, my goodness. It's racist. Is it really?
Everything is racist.
Of course it is. Sharpton blamed this supposed racist policy on the basis that schools that minority students attend are underfunded and crowded, and that students and teachers will not be able to abide by social distancing requirements. Quote, even these very basic precautions will be out of reach for many students of color who disproportionately attend schools that are underfunded and overcrowded. What Sharpton declined to mention in his memo to Trump is how low-income students were the ones that were hurt the most by the schools closing in the spring. During the months of remote learning, 40% of black students received no instruction during the coronavirus outbreak, while only 10% of white students received no instruction. Only 14% of black students received average or above average remote instruction, and 46% received low quality instruction. Black students lost an average of 10.3 months of learning, compared to white students who only lost about 6 months of learning. Based on all available data, school closures hurt minority communities, specifically black communities, which is why it's so important to reopen schools this fall. Sharpton eventually revealed his true motivation for the tirade. It was not about racism, children's safety, or education. He only cared about getting Trump out of office. He said, luckily for the American people, Mr. President, you don't have the power to force any public schools open. And if you still don't have a grasp of how governmental authority is split 3.5 years into your term, it's time voters teach you a valuable lesson at the ballot box. Sharpton made this segment entirely about urging his viewers to vote Trump out of office, rather than to talk about the actual educational issues black students have to deal with when the schools are closed. It's interesting that at this point on this particular topic, the Reverend Al actually seems to understand governmental authority, federal authority, because the federal government in Washington, D.C., there are some things it cannot do to force the states to do things. It just can't. Which is why President Trump has not done certain things that the left is demanding he do, such as a nationwide mandate on wearing masks in public. That's something constitutionally he can't do. That's up to the states. But if you ask the Reverend Al about that, he would say, of course the president needs to do that. He needs to declare a national statute that everybody has to wear masks. It's for the good of the people. The Reverend Al would agree with that. But he makes this sending kids to school a racist issue. It's not a racist issue. And the science, the real science, is telling us that the kids need to be back in school. Educators, doctors, well, actually doctors across America, even interviewed by liberal leftist news outlets, are saying, oh yeah, I want my kids to go back to school. Have no reservations about it at all. We already have reports. I told you about the one out of Iceland the other day. There's a larger report out of Germany saying the kids aren't in danger. They're not catching it, and they're not spreading it. So let's send them back to school. They need to be back in school. They need to be learning. They need to be with each other. Will kids get sick? Darn tootin' they will, but not from the COVID. You and I both know that when it comes time to send the kids back to school after being out for an extended period, they come home sniffling. They come home little snot boxes. They come home because some kids are spreading things around. A kid gets a cold. Pretty soon, most of the class has the cold. But not COVID. in Iceland and in Germany, they ran expansive tests. And they learned they're not transmitting it. They're not just asymptomatic. They're not getting it. And they're not sharing it with anybody because they're not getting it. They're not the super spreaders the lying leftists would like you to believe they are. And in spite of the Reverend Al and his assertions, it's not racist to send kids back to school because you want the minority children to get sick and die, which is what he's saying. Oh, the president just wants the kids to go back to school because he wants black children to get sick and die of the COVID. That's disgusting. It's revolting. But that's Al Sharpton. And that's leftism. That's how it works. It's disgusting and it's revolting. And on the state level, some things that are disgusting and revolting are being done in the name of fighting COVID-19 and the coronavirus. For example, in Ohio, where Republican Governor Mike DeWine last week ordered residents of 7 Ohio counties, including Cuyahoga County, to wear face masks in public. You see, he can do that on the state level. The governor tried to issue a mandatory mask mandate for all of Ohio back in April, but he withdrew the order after public backlash. This new order, targeting more populous counties considered to have a higher number of coronavirus cases, has had mixed reactions from the counties themselves. Butler County Sheriff Richard K. Jones, an outspoken Republican, has said he won't enforce the order. He said on Twitter, "I'm not the mask police." However, Cuyahoga County, that's where Cleveland is the county seat, that's considered a Democratic stronghold. It's a Democratic, county executive, Armand Budish, will be a delegate to the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee next month. His reaction to the mandate was very different from that of Sheriff Jones. On Friday, Budish announced a new snitch line where county residents can report fellow citizens they see not wearing a mask. He released a phone number and online addresses where people could report their fellow citizens. He said, "If you see situations where people are not following the mask mandate, you may call that number or go to that web address." He proceeded to sound a lot like a good Leninist as he warned citizens the government will be watching. He said, When we receive information about mask compliance issues from the community, we intend to contact a business owner, if relevant, or the relevant individuals to let them know information has been received. We also intend to inform the local city, village, or township as well. If repeated complaints are received or serious noncompliance is raised under the state order, the county sheriff would have the authority to investigate and potentially take further action. In other words, we're watching you. We're watching you. Cleveland TV station WKYC reports, according to Budish, his office's legal research determined a violation of the order would constitute a second-degree misdemeanor, punishable by up to 90 days in jail and a $750 fine. But local municipalities will have leeway to enact their own, possibly non-criminal penalties. You know, Bill de Blasio tried to do this in New York. Didn't work out well for him. He had to take it down. Got flooded with Hitler memes and male genitalia pictures. Folks in Cuyahoga County need to fight back. But what's happening is that people are complaining. 500 since the 3 p.m. on Friday to Monday. Apparently, some of the people of Ohio are embracing this guy's communism. And here we go. jumping feet first into the final segment of this Wednesday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. As long as we're talking about the COVID, the Rona, can we talk about New York? If only the rest of the country could handle COVID as well as New York. That's what you're hearing from the progressive commentators in the news media today. While COVID cases are spiking in the Sun Belt and the South. Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin hailed New York City the other day after it reported no deaths for the first time during the pandemic. This is what competent government can accomplish, she gushed. Former Obama aide Valerie Jarrett took to Twitter to say short-term sacrifice saves lives with 3 exclamation points. Neera Tanden, the head of the progressive think tank at the Center for American Progress, contrasted the response in Democratic states to that in Republican states, saying, "It turns out we were lucky that the virus hit in blue states first. They had the thinking to take action to stop the spread of the virus in their states." This is really all perverse, given that New York is only now emerging from one of the worst COVID debacles on the planet. There is nonetheless a widespread feeling that New York has been blessed with its exemplary leadership. Governor Andrew Cuomo, incredibly enough, has sky-high approval ratings. If New York is going to be held up as the model, every office holder in the country has a new roadmap for handling the virus. See a significant percentage of residents of your largest city get infected. Excuse me, barely prevent your hospital system from getting overwhelmed. Implement a policy that increases infections and deaths at nursing homes. Suffer more than 30,000 deaths and a higher per capita death rate than any country in the world. And then after all that, get hailed as a hero. If it worked for Cuomo, why not every other governor in the nation? In fairness, New York had many factors working against it. It was hit first, while the virus and how to treat it were still poorly understood. And New York City is an international travel hub with densely packed neighborhoods and a heavily trafficked public transit system. Of course, it got hammered. The outbreaks in other parts of the country aren't anything like what happened in New York, at least not yet. What states like Florida, Arizona, Texas, and California are trying to do is avoid New York's fate, even as they're lectured about the superiority of the Empire State's approach. The positivity rate, the percentage of tests coming back positive, has increased in all of these places, and in Arizona has gone above 20%. During the worst of the outbreak in New York, the 7-day moving average for the positivity rate reached an astronomical 50%. And by the way, we found out yesterday that in Florida, those test rates were wildly overstated. They were saying 90% 98% positive, and it turned out, oops, that was a typo. It was supposed to be 9.8%. Deaths are also going up in all these states, but the scale so far is completely different from what New York experienced. In New York, about 32,500 people have died. In Florida, a state of comparable population, about 4,300 people have died. In Texas and California, both of them bigger states, 3,300 and about 7,000, as opposed to New York's 32,500. In per capita terms, New York has had 1,668 deaths per million. Arizona, 308 per million. Florida, 199. California, 179. Texas, 114. Just in terms of the sheer numbers, New York should be a watchword, not something to emulate. It is in a better situation now, but only after the virus burned through much of the city. A state survey found that more than 20% of New York City residents have antibodies to the virus. At clinics in some hard-hit neighborhoods, about 60% of the people have tested positive for antibodies. this isn't an experience anyone should want to duplicate. The fact is, the virus isn't interested in scoring partisan points or establishing the superiority of red state versus blue state governance. It's highly infectious and is now hitting places it missed earlier in the pandemic as they've started to reopen. We should wish them the very best and fervently hope they don't suffer the same calamity that befell New York. Those are the words of Rich Lowry over at New York Post. He's right. New York is not the example. Not by a long shot. Of course, the progressive press is going to treat progressive leaders with worshipful reverence. And they're going to say, oh, this is wonderful. You remember the news conferences and how the progressive press was fawning all over the people? Do you remember? Oh, this is true leadership. In contrast to Trump, who actually pulled out a panel of experts to report on things and to correct the assumptions made by the press at news conferences, and who actually showed real leadership and whose poll numbers rose during those pandemic press briefings. You remember those? It was doing so much good for him that CNN stopped carrying them. So don't make the mistake of believing New York has their act together. They're actually the worst example. And the guy in charge in New York City, the mayor of New York City, America's largest metropolis, one of the world's true international cities, being the mayor there is a really high-profile job. It rarely leads to a higher office, but that's okay. No sitting mayor of any city has ever become president of the United States. In fact, no mayor has ever even come close to winning the White House. Even Rudy Giuliani, whose solid leadership following 9/11, which earned him the nickname America's Mayor, he failed in his 2008 bid. Only Grover Cleveland and Calvin Coolidge actually had previous experience as mayors. Nevertheless, New York City mayors wield political influence beyond their municipal borders. They live and work in the media capital of the world. They manage government budgets that are larger than all but a handful of states, and they govern a population of 8.3 million that dwarfs that of other American municipalities. In a city that prides itself on producing brash, even egotistical people, it's virtually impossible to be a New York mayor and be low profile. And so it is with the current mayor, Bill de Blasio. Entering the halfway point of his second term, de Blasio has been part of the national political conversation since first taking office in 2014. Being a mayor of a major city, it's safe to assume de Blasio is left of center. That's the nature of big city politics in modern America. Few people outside of New York City know who he is, even after his pathetic 2020 presidential run, which lasted all of 4 months. It'd be a mistake to underestimate de Blasio, though, or the harm he can do to the country through the ideas he champions. You see, Bill de Blasio is no ordinary liberal mayor. In fact, the case could be made that de Blasio is a stone-cold Marxist. De Blasio was born Warren Wilhelm Jr. in 1961 to left elite parents. His father was Warren Wilhelm Sr., a Harvard and Yale graduate. His mother was Maria de Blasio, who went to Smith College, both of whom had government jobs, but left under suspicion of having communist sympathies. His alcoholic father abandoned the family when Warren Jr. was 7, later committed suicide. Because of this, Warren Jr., who was raised along with his siblings by his mother, later changed his name to Bill de Blasio, taking his mother's maiden name, and Bill was a nickname. He spent most of his young life in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but moved to New York City to attend NYU and later Columbia to pursue his interest in politics and government. Always holding close to his parents' leftist ideals, he went to Nicaragua in the 1980s, where he gained sympathy for the Soviet-backed communist Sandinista regime. The Sandinistas had an iron grip on the country, imprisoning and murdering civilians and fighting the U.S.-backed Contras. De Blasio was impressed with the socialist style of government. According to the New York Times, De Blasio returned from that visit with a vision of the possibilities of an unfettered leftist government. And that's the guy in charge of New York City today. He's a Marxist. And his mayorship has cost thousands of lives during the coronavirus pandemic. The link to this and more is in today's show notes. Make sure you get them. That's it for today. God bless you. No podcast tomorrow. We'll see you back here Friday for the next edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. God bless. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.